Hey, everybody. Today on the Charlie Kirk Show, Newt Gingrich joins us about his new book, Defeating Big Government Socialism. And then Michelle Tafoya joins us. You might remember her on Sunday Night Football. Great episode. Email me your thoughts, as always, freedom@charliekirk.com. And take out your podcast app and type in Charlie Kirk Show and subscribe in the upper right-hand corner. Sass, sass, sass. All of you are welcome, and you got to buy your tickets right now. We are just hours away from our Student Action Summit. All ages welcome. TPUSA.com/SAS. That is TPUSA.com/SAS. Check it out right now. TPUSA.com/SAS. Laura Ingraham, Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, Greg Gutfeld, and then Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump, brought to you by Turning Point Action. Buckle up, everybody. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Brought to you by the loan experts I trust, Andrew and Todd at Sierra Pacific Mortgage at andrewandtodd.com. With us right now is somebody that I think I watched for over a decade, my entire life on Sunday Night Football. And I think she was somewhere before Sunday Night Football. And with us is Michelle Tafoya, host of Sideline Sanity podcast and formerly with NBC's Sunday Night Football, sideline reporter. Michelle, welcome to the Charlie Kirk Show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Of course. And so tell us about your story. You were canceled in some way, shape, or form. I think it'd be really curious for our audience to learn about it.
Well, you know what? I really wasn't. And some people are under the assumption that I was fired from NBC or let go. No, I had given my notice to NBC back in 2018 because I wanted to start a podcast, believe it or not. A lot of people can't believe that because the gig on Sunday Night Football was amazing. Plus, I got to cover the Olympics. It was all incredible. But I didn't feel like I was using my voice in the way that I wanted to be using my voice. It was a very limiting job for someone like me who has a lot to say. And so while I gave my notice in 2018, 2019 was supposed to be my final year. Then they said, could you just get us through the Super Bowl in a couple? So I stayed the extra COVID year and then the following season to get them through this Los Angeles Super Bowl, as they put it. And it was a joy. But in the meantime, yeah, I couldn't express a lot of the things I wanted to express because I didn't want to bring any controversy to the network or to the show. And unfortunately, sometimes the most innocuous things can bring controversy. So they were very careful and I respected that. And that's why I stepped away.
So I want to talk to you about kind of the erosion in trust in media. You've been part of media,
Yeah. Obviously.
I want to play cut 212. This is NBC's Katie Tour admitting that no one trusts them anymore and wondering out loud whether or not they're doing more harm than good. I'd love your reaction. Play cut 212.
There was just a Gallup poll out today that shows that the trust in media and newspapers and television is, you know, hitting an all-time low. People don't trust us. They don't believe us. And it makes me wonder if this job, as I'm currently doing it, is effective. But if it's doing more harm than good, I don't have a good answer for that.
Michelle, your reaction.
Well, I respect her for asking the question because a lot of journalists won't even ask themselves that question. What am I doing here? Am I doing the job the right way, et cetera, et cetera. I watch White House press conferences very often and get so frustrated because I don't think these journalists, and I almost put those little air quotes because they're not doing their jobs the way that they should. So often there's no pushback on the questions. There's just, it's as though they're there. They're honored to be there. They think that it is an honor to be there. And I suppose that it is an honor to be a White House correspondent, but do the job, ask the tough questions. And we just aren't seeing a lot of that. And then I think too, there's just been this erosion given the way that the media has really shown it's bias. I don't think there's any arguing that. If, and, you know, everyone comes back with, well, Fox News this and Newsmax that. Well, yes, I think there had to be some sort of an answer to the very left-leaning mainstream media, if you will, legacy media, whatever you'd like to call it. And so Roger Ailes, I think very brilliantly decided, let's go this other direction. And as you've seen, there is just as big an audience for a different point of view. So, you know, and I respect the job that Fox News does with its journalists, too. I'm not just talking about its opinions, its opinion editors and writers and anchors, but it's news. But yes, we've been misinformed multiple times. And then we found out about it. And by the way, no one takes accountability after we discovered they've misinformed us or blocked information from us. And when you don't take accountability, you lose credibility. So, yes, it's going on. Absolutely.
Did you how did you see this kind of censorship regime impact what you did at NBC? I mean, NBC has been, I mean, I'm not a fan, obviously, at all, but sports has become very political. And this has kind of infected what's happened there. What can you tell our audience about how that impacted kind of what you saw at NBC?
Well, fortunately, in the world of sports, even though, yes, it did become more political, you didn't have, quote unquote, censorship. We at Sunday Night Football, at any rate, we wanted to simply document what was going on in the game. And very oftentimes that meant, starting with Colin Kaepernick, the kneeling, that whole anthem era. We covered the national anthem in a totally different way because we were looking for, okay, who is kneeling? And that became the story. Or how are people supporting the kneelers or who's not kneeling? It was just a very big part of the story. So I didn't see really censorship in that regard. What I will say, and I was very fortunate to work at NBC Sports. And I think you have to separate NBC Sports from the rest of NBC. They're all their own entities. And certainly Sunday Night Football was its own, you know, little gem. And we just wanted to document things and get things right. At the same time, in 2018, when I wanted to start a podcast, I sent my demo episode to some folks at NBC Sports and said, this is the kind of thing I want to do. And they just said, can we please ask you to wait until you leave NBC? Because, you know, we don't want to bring any kind of shade onto Sunday Night Football. I agreed to that. I could have left right then and there. I did not. I'm very loyal to the people who brought me on there. It's a family at NBC Sports that's unique. And so, but they didn't want my opinions verbalized very widely. And so then when I went on The View in November of my last season of Sunday Night Football, they allowed me to do that. We all knew it was my final season of Sunday Night Football. So they said, you know what, if you were going to be with us another few years, we would not let you do this appearance. But because you're wrapping up, we're going to let you do it. I did 2 days on The View and I was told, that's it. You're not doing any more. They just thought that my comments were, I guess, too on the edge of controversy, things about Colin Kaepernick, et cetera. And so, you know what? Again, I honored that because I just respect the people that I work for. I understood what they were trying to accomplish, that they didn't want to bring any of this to that product. I think their most valuable entity, and NBC in total right now, is Sunday Night Football. So I agreed to that.
So NCAA faces backlash after biological male Leah Thomas nominated for Woman of the Year. I won't even say Leah Thomas. Let's just say Thomas, nominated for Woman of the Year award. Your thoughts?
Well, they're going to face a lot of backlash. And then they're going to face the politically correct folks who say, yes, she's a woman. She deserves to be nominated. You know, look, I've had a lot of conversations with Olympic swimmers. I'm not going to name names because these were off the record conversations. They're furious. They think this is outrageous that Leah Thomas so quickly was able to get into the pool and compete alongside women. It isn't fair. I think this is just an additional sort of slap in the face to women who have been competing and working their butts off to compete against one another in this classification for their entire lives. being denied a spot on a team, being denied a spot at NCAAs, being denied a spot on the podium. And now this, I'm a little flabbergasted.
Yeah, well, that's where we're at. NCAA faces backlash trying to make a man woman of the year. There you go. And Martina Navratilova, I never could pronounce that right, spoke out.
Navratilova, yeah.
Yeah, spoke against
it. Yes, she did. She did. And so then people yell at her. So I commend her for continuing to speak out.
That's what they do. Look, we talk about current events a lot on this show, but there's other things that are in life that are bigger than current events, bigger things. We try to do some shows every so often on these things. But look, what am I talking about when I say that? How about good and evil, right and wrong, prayer in the Bible or heaven and hell? So look, the great C.S. Lewis, who's one of the most amazing minds ever to exist, was a master at addressing these questions. And that is why Hillsdale College, the great college, the only college, in my opinion, wants you to learn more about him and his writings in their newest free online course, C.S. Lewis on Christianity. And it all starts with taking a short quiz to find out how much you already know about Lewis. He wrote more than the Narnia series, by the way. Look, Hillsdale College is amazing. They defend liberty. They pursue truth. They do a great job. So just write this down. This should be your go-to resource. Remember, I have taken 16 of their online courses, and I have promised Dr. Arne I'm eventually going to finish them all. Go to charlie4hillsdale.com to take this fun interactive quiz and then sign up for this free course. The answers may even surprise you, even if you think you know everything about C.S. Lewis. They surprised me, my goodness. The quiz, the course, and everything you learn at Hillsdale College are yours for free, as always. So take the C.S. Lewis quiz, charlie4hillsdale.com. That is charlie4hillsdale.com. Take as many online courses as you can. The Constitution course is amazing, but their C.S. Lewis course is extraordinary. And by the way, Hillsdale College, just phenomenal. charlie4hillsdale.com. Michelle, I want to talk to you about this story in Minneapolis involving Andrew Tekel Sundberg. In the day following the death of Andrew Tekel Sundberg after an hours-long standoff in an apartment building in the Seward neighborhood of Minneapolis, a newly released search warrant says snipers from the Minneapolis Police Department fired the fatal rounds that killed him. And then it seems as if BLM comes in response to try to gin up all this controversy. Walk us through this story, please.
I'll tell you what I do know, and I certainly haven't reported on it, but I do live here in the area. So this young man was in an apartment and began to shoot bullets through the wall of his apartment, allegedly. I'm just going to say allegedly for now. The woman whose apartment was receiving the incoming bullets called 911, which, if you might remember back in 2020, a Minneapolis city councilwoman called 911, being able to call 911, coming from a place of privilege. She was part of the defund movement. Anyhow, back to this story. The woman in the apartment calls 911. The police come. They try to extricate her and her two small children from this situation without getting them hurt any further. The police take then some oncoming bullet fire. So what ends up happening following that is a 6-hour standoff. The parents of this young man, by the way, they were adoptive parents, come and text with him, phone with him, send him videos, according to all the reporting, and try to talk him down from what they're calling a mental health situation. And I frankly would argue that most kind of these sort of shootings result from a mental health situation. Anyway, they try to talk him down. Nothing's working. This standoff goes on for 6 hours. SWAT comes in and sniper fire is used to take this man out. At this point, we don't know what in that moment made the SWAT officers decide that this was the only way out of the situation. But that's what they decided. And the young man was killed. Now, what is trying to be made of this story is that this is, again, another example of police officers shooting a black man. But this was not an unarmed black man. So these Black Lives Matter protesters show up in front of the apartment building to mourn his passing. But that's not all they were doing. The woman who was the victim in all of this, whose apartment was being shot into, showed up and said, look, George Floyd wasn't armed. Breonna Taylor wasn't armed. This guy was armed, and he was shooting bullets into my apartment while I was trying to feed dinner to my two black mm-hmm. children. And they were kind of like, oh, she's having a moment. Let's let her grieve.
Sounds like. I want to play the tape of that really quick just to add context yeah. to that. All right, play cut
yes,
210.
Yes, please do.
210.
George Floyd was not armed. Breonna Taylor was not armed. This man intentionally tried to kill us. For 3 years I lived here, and none of you guys knocked on that man's door to see if he was okay. Not at all. He played loud music every day to cope with his mindset. There was casings in the hallway. The shot went through my door to the pillar to the kitchen. I was cooking food for my kids.
He's dead now, so that can't happen.
He shouldn't know. It doesn't matter. He shouldn't have been dead. Y'all should have came and helped him when he was alive.
No, I don't.
Now I can't get my shit because all you guys want to be here. My kids have to see you guys celebrate a man's life.
Michelle.
I mean, it says it all, right? She, as furious and passionate as she is, she appears to be the same one in this picture. She's depicting what happened to her and her kids, and they're all talking to her like she's from outer space and, you know, idiotic and insane. And all she wants to do is get back into her building to get her stuff. And it's to me, it just that speech by that woman says it all. Mm-hmm. And she's right. They weren't there for him before all of this. People go to the moment of the shooting and conveniently forget about everything that led up to that yep. moment when yep. there could have been intervention and there wasn't.
She almost died and they're mourning the criminal gunman. That tells you everything about BLM and raising money on it, maybe to go buy more mansions mm-hmm. fraudulently. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us. The Sideline Sanity podcast. Check it out. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Charlie. Take care.
Hey, everybody, Charlie Kirk here. How long can we endure this skyrocketing inflation? Millions of Americans can no longer afford to put food on the table and gas in their tanks. If you're feeling the pain, here's how to fight back. Get yourself some long-term emergency food from My Patriot Supply. My Patriot Supply is the nation's largest preparedness and self-reliance company with millions of happy prepared customers and more than 55,000 four-star and five-star reviews. Right now, save $150 on their three-month emergency food kit by going to preparewithkirk.com. This kit contains breakfast, lunch, dinner, drinks, and snacks. That's over 2,000 calories per day for 3 solid months. Get one kit for each person in your family. There's no limit to how many you can order. Make sure you have their food stocked for when you need it. Get it today, preparewithkirk.com. I have stashes of this stuff. You are 9 meals away from anarchy. Our team at Turning Point USA loves it. Everyone I know is ordering it. You'll save $150 and get free shipping as well. Preparewithkirk.com. Preparewithkirk.com. Joining us right now is someone who I consider to be one of the wisest, if not the wisest person in the entire conservative movement, who has a phenomenal new book out, Defeating Big Government Socialism, Saving America's Future. Buy a copy right now. It is Newt Gingrich. Mr. Speaker, welcome back to the program.
As always, it's great to be back with you. And I had a chance, by the way, to be with the Patriot Mobile people a few weeks ago, and they're really quite impressive.
They are, and they're doing something very important, which is to create alternatives in kind of a parallel economy. I actually want to ask you about that, but first, tell us about your book. I have an endorsement of it. I enthusiastically endorsed it. Why did you write it now, of all times? And we'll go from there.
Well, it was clear that the Biden approach was going to fail disastrously, that it was going to cause a lot of pain to the American people and a lot of risk to America as a country, and that there was a danger that people would just write it off as a defect of people. You know, that Buttigieg isn't very smart, Kamala Harris is weird, Biden is cognitively challenged, et cetera. But the truth is that the underlying problem is that their ideas are wrong. Mm. Ronald Reagan used to say he wasn't worried by what liberals didn't know. He was worried by what they knew that wasn't true. Mm. And of course, he went from 1.4% inflation under Trump to over 9% inflation under Biden. You went for more than doubling the price of gasoline since Trump left office. You have millions of people crossing the American border, being given free cell phones by the taxpayer cell phones, flown around the country by your government. You have murderers being released on the street, and then we're shocked at the size of the crime wave. All of these things are a function of a philosophy and attitude and approach, which is wrong. And I think it's very important in 22 and 24 that we not just win a performance election, look how bad things are, we also win a policy and philosophy election. Yeah. Look how profoundly destructive they are. And the purpose of defeating big government socialism was to give people a citizen's handbook, if you will, to arm them with the information to be able to win that argument.
That is so important. And I think you hit on something very profound, which every time I see a mailer or a commercial hitting Joe Biden's lack of mental acuity or Kamala Harris's cackle, or as you said, you called one of them weird. I couldn't help but laugh. It's so true. It doesn't quite build the proper referendum on what we're actually facing, because those are interchangeable parts, right? They'll find a younger Biden. They'll find a younger Kamala Harris. What we're actually facing is an ideological battle, which in some sense is a lot more formidable than just kind of a group of charismatic politicians. So we have to understand that we're up against something that the academics believe, the college campuses believe, big companies believe. What is that ideology exactly, Mr. Speaker? What are they trying to push us towards? And why is it important that we diagnose that correctly?
I think big government socialism comes down to ultimately two really big ideas. The first is that bureaucratic systems run by politicians make better choices, are better able for the average person. They take your money away, but then they spend it smarter than you would. And I think that's a genuine belief that goes back at least to the 1870s or 1880s. Second, there has been this entire emergence of a kind of coming together of everybody who's weird in the country, all of them identifying with each other and deciding that they'll support each other's mutual weirdness.
That's exactly
so,
right.
So, if you believe that third graders ought to be deeply involved in discussing transgender issues, and you believe that 7-year-old white girls should be taught that they should feel bad because of their skin color, which is pure racism, and you think that murderers should be actually favored because, after all, look how much pain they must be in if they have to kill somebody. All of these things come together in a way which is a very, very unusual pattern. And it's the combination of the huge bureaucratic machine that doesn't work, that grinds up money, ultimately makes all of us much poorer, and transfers power to bureaucrats. And so we cease to be citizens and we become subjects. And then second, it's an almost Bolshevik-like desire to destroy traditional America and replace it with a new model, left-wingism.
Yes.
And they're very clear about that. I mean, they don't hide it.
So, Mr. Speaker, something that normal people have difficulty stomaching right now is how much pain and suffering that we're living through and whether or not this is intentional. Can you help build out how the big government socialists see all this as transitory? Not that inflation is necessarily transitory, but the pain and the suffering will lead us through a synthesis towards some form of utopia. Can you talk about how dangerous that is and how we're actually living through the intentional combination of the destruction of Western society to bring us towards some undefined academic experiment?
Well, look, I think it's pretty clear that they say this. If they have to punish you into leaving traditional cars, they will. Washington, D.C. just adopted a provision against using natural gas. Now, this is both environmentally insane and it's financially insane, and it's going to particularly hit the poor. The Northeastern Compact on the environment has basically cut out all of the new pipelines, which means that heating oil in New Hampshire and in Maine is going to be much more expensive this fall. Well, if you're in a relatively poor state like Maine, having a dramatically more expensive heating oil is a huge burden on the working families and the retired families in the state of Maine. But it doesn't matter to these people. They don't care how much pain they cause. They are in the business of imposing on the rest of us the values that will make us better if only we do what they tell us. And I think you have to see it that way. They're very clear about it. And then, of course, when you catch them in public and the pain level gets high enough and they start thinking about the election, then all of a sudden, you know, you have Biden running off to Saudi Arabia. But notice, he could have, you know, just dropped into Texas. He could have visited Western Pennsylvania. He could have gone to North Dakota.
That's exactly
but
right.
That would have required being pro-American. And one of the key ground rules for these people is you're not allowed to be pro-American.
Yeah, he could have visited the Bakken or the Marcellus or the Permian Basin, but Riyadh just seemed to be a nicer flight or something. One thing that I'm a little paranoid about, though, Mr. Speaker, and I talk about this openly on the program, is that the Democrats have some sort of plan for the midterms that we might not yet be gaming out correctly. Because I have so much respect for our opposition and how Machiavellian they are and how they're able to use tragedy for their own purposes. What do you think their midterm plan is? Because up until recently, you know, as per your example of the Saudi Arabian visit, it seems as if they are enthusiastically accelerating over a cliff. Political consequences be damned, I suppose. What's your thoughts?
Well, I think, first of all, I helped publish papers in the 1980s called the Grenada Papers. When we liberated the island of Grenada, which spoke English, this was an island occupied largely by Africans living in the Caribbean with agriculture and tourism as their two biggest incomes. And the communists took it over. And as the communists tried to impose communism, everything fell apart. It was a disaster. So we now know, because this is how we got to the Grenada Papers, because everything they wrote was in English. So we didn't need a translator. The State Department couldn't screw it up. And it turns out that the leadership of the Communist Party of Grenada, when everything was failing, would meet every Tuesday afternoon for a study group. And what they were studying was not supply-side economics. It wasn't Milton Friedman. It wasn't Adam Smith. What they were studying was Stalin's writing. Now, you have a Georgian bank robber who becomes dictator of a country that covers 13 time zones, living in Moscow in a really bad cold winter, being studied by African-descended Caribbean native folks who are looking around going, what should we do next? Well, what does Stalin think we should do? The reason I tell you this story is when AOC gets in a room, she doesn't have any point of reference. But I mean, Biden's different. Biden doesn't have a point of reference because he's not sure what room he's in. But I guarantee you that Newsom, Kamala Harris, various other people, Senator Warren, Bernie Sanders, who remember honeymooned in the Soviet Union. I mean, just ask yourself, a guy who is born, he's born in Brooklyn, but a guy who is living in the forest of Vermont decides to go on a honeymoon. Does he go to the Caribbean? Does he go to the beach? No, he goes to the motherland, to the great forest of Russia, from the forest of Vermont. I mean, this is a true believer. Mm. And Bernie's a true believer. You have to give him some credit for that. He's a genuine, unending socialist who does not have a clue how disastrous his policies would be in the real world.
I always joke around, but I'm very serious when I'm making this joke. I'd much rather have a corrupt politician than an ideological one. A corrupt one I can work with, like Bill Clinton. I mean, you worked with Bill Clinton very well. Bill Clinton is as corrupt as it gets, but he'd do a deal, because I don't think Bill Clinton is nearly as ideological as Bernie Sanders or the people controlling Joe Biden or Barack Obama, which... you could say what you want about Bill Clinton, but he came to the table with you and you guys got a lot done. Balanced the budget, welfare reform, great crime bill, all these things. So, Mr. Speaker, I want to ask you, it's not just about government power, though, that gives people anxiety. It's also the amount of cultural and corporate power that the left has been able to assume. You talk about this in the book, but how are we to approach Google that could arguably be just as or even more powerful than parts of our government? Or Disney that has control over our children's, you know, what they're consuming. Big government socialism, is it also incorporate cultural and economic power?
Yeah, it has to. And also, let me take those two examples. We clearly are going to have to ultimately set some kind of rules of the road for these big internet companies. I mean, we would not allow AT&T or Verizon to have the kind of control over our communication, our conversations that these companies now exercise. In terms of Disney, I think somebody ought to be filing a stockholder lawsuit.
Yes.
The Disney president made a decision which has cost Disney an enormous amount of money in the collapse of its stock. And they ought to be held accountable for that. When you start making uneconomic policies, you know, the same thing happened in Atlanta with the Major League Baseball All-Star Game, where Coca-Cola and Delta, two of the biggest corporations in Georgia, both of them acted against their own economic interest by siding on a totally false lie, siding with the left and demanding that the All-Star Game be moved, which, of course, the Braves then responded by winning the World Series. So in a sense, Georgians got their ball game without having to give up their honor.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And to your example, Walt Disney, since its peak, its stock has been cut in half since they've started to go woke.
Right.
Half of their market cap.
I don't see why that should not be a litigatable circumstance.
I totally agree.
Say that this person has violated their fiduciary obligations and has put their politics and their prejudice ahead of their duty to the stockholder.
That's well said. So, Mr. Speaker, going into the midterms, how does all of this incorporate into a political strategy and a messaging strategy?
Well, people can go to AmericanMajorityProject.com and they'll see all of our polling and all of our focus groups. My personal prediction is that the Republicans in the House are going to be somewhere between plus 40 and plus 70, and that there's going to be a parallel swing in the Senate. And the reason is simple. This is going to be an American tsunami, not a red tsunami. You're going to have Democrats, independents, Republicans, you're going to have Latinos, African-Americans, Asian-Americans, all of them migrating away from the failed policies of the big government socialist. And I think the result's going to be an astonishing election. My advice to Republicans is simple. Run big. Don't run small. Raise the big issues. Every Democrat on the ballot is responsible for 9% inflation. Every Democrat in the ballot is responsible for doubling the price of gasoline. Every Democrat in the ballot is responsible for millions of people crossing the border illegally. And every Democrat in the ballot is responsible for murderers and rapists and robbers being released from prison. Yes. So if you make it a big issue election, we're going to win everywhere. And it could be the biggest Republican victory since 1920. 102 years ago.
I totally agree. The ideology they are embracing, they're talking about a liberal world order. They're all these, that's deeply unpopular with normal everyday people. Look at Hispanics. I mean, you know political trends well. Is it too early to say that Hispanics could potentially be a Republican majority demographic?
No, look, what's happened, simple. On the performance side, if you're a Hispanic family, you can't afford the gasoline to drive to the 7 stores you have to go to find the baby formula. You can't afford to buy dinner. And you personally came here legally, or you were born here, and you resent lots of people arriving illegally who are raising the crime rate. So all those things are going on simultaneously. At the same time, you're probably pretty religious, and you really deeply dislike the left and its anti-religious biases. So all of those things are swirling around. And what's happened is Republicans are trading liberal, graduate-educated whites for working-class Hispanics, Latinos, Asian-Americans.
I'll take that trade any day.
Yeah. Well, if you believe in government of the people, we're on the way to winning it, and they're on the way to losing it.
That's right. They can have as many upper-middle-class, Upper East Side liberal women that went to Yale, Columbia, and Dartmouth. We'll take the Rio Grande Valley and West Phoenix. And we'll see what happens.
If you can't define what a woman is, you should be a Democrat.
Beautifully said. Defeating Big Government Socialism by Speaker Newt Gingrich. Check it out. Buy a couple copies. It is a citizen's handbook. It's a phenomenal book. Thank you so much, Mr. Speaker. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Email me your thoughts, as always, freedom@charliekirk.com. Thanks so much for listening. God bless.
For more on many of these stories and news you can trust, go to charliekirk.com.